So there are three stages of Joseph's time in Egypt. And when we get to stage three, Joseph is exalted to be number two ruler in all the kingdom of Egypt. And in that position, he saved Egypt from the famine and all the world round about, and that also included his brethren of Israel. In so doing, he typifies Jesus, the world savior. Next slide. If we could have the next slide, please. Okay. First, we'll take a little bit of a look at archaeology. Now, that may not be of interest to everybody, but if you are talking to somebody who says, oh, these things are just stories, they must be because we don't have any evidence of them. Let's take a look and see. Now, it's likely that Joseph was put into the king's prison just almost at the very end of the reign of Sesostris III. Now, that's a name you probably don't have to remember. Now, when he goes out of office, the chances are that Potiphar, the head of the guard, would also go out of office in favor of the choice of the next king, Amenemhes III. Now, there are five mysteries that archaeologists generally confess to, and there is a solution. One, there are stone quarries at a region called Hammamat, a bit east of the Nile River and south of the Delta. And strangely, they were shut down for 15 years. Now, they were used for mining the stones for making monuments of various pharaohs and other prominent figures. Then second, for some reason, there's a region called the Fayum that's west of the Nile River, and there's a place called Lake Moeris, and a lot of it was swampland, and about 90 square kilometers of it was drained to create more farmland. Now, that's about 35 square miles. I'm sure Brother Mike Ensley can appreciate that. You can grow an awful lot of food on that farmland. Then the road from the Nile River up to the Fayum district is marked by two great huge statues of this king, Amenemhes III, each 60 feet tall on either side of the road. Why were they constructed and why were they constructed there? Then, it's interesting to note that the local rulers, they called them nomarchs, became very wealthy early in the reign of Amenemhes III, but they were dreadfully impoverished later on. And yet there wasn't any sign of rebellion and having a rebellion put down. And then there are much smaller statues of Amenemhes III that are found far outside of Egypt, all the way from Byblos in Lebanon, all down to the Sudan, south of Egypt. And yet it wasn't because there was war, because in fact, this was a peaceful pharaoh, unlike the others. Yes, he had a war in a second year and a third year, and that appears to have been the last of the wars of Pharaoh Amenemhes III. Or in the Egyptian, Amenemhat III. So, when we solve the mysteries, we find that if the quarries for mining the basalt stone for making great monuments, that it was shut down for 15 years, that's an interesting number because Joseph came to power in 1 year, followed by 7 years of bumper crop, followed by 7 years of famine. After that, then they could start mining to make statues of King Amenemhes III. And what was the purpose of draining a good part of Lake Moeris in the Fayum district? to create more farmland. It's so that they could create more farmland in addition to what bumper crops they were growing elsewhere. And it's possible that even they could, by draining the swamp, get a certain amount of farm crops during the 7 years of famine. The latter part, I don't know for sure. Now, we can see how Amenemhes III, by making Joseph number two ruler in domestic affairs, controlling all of the domestic affairs of Egypt, and it got them through 7 years of famine, then there was a reason to commemorate this pharaoh, Amenemhes. The local rulers became wealthy early in the reign of Amenemhes. And why would that be? Because the seven bumper crop years, they would be doing fine. Actually, they might not have been doing fine if you consider the law of supply and demand. When there's too much supply, farm prices go down. So Pharaoh steps in here under Joseph to sort of empty Pharaoh's treasury over these 7 years and buy the excess of food, buy all the food that they could. They spent their time building up places to store it and store it without rats and mice getting in so that they had enough food for the 7 years of famine. Well, when the famine came, then the local areas became poorer and poorer and poorer, and their nomarchs or local rulers with them. There was no sign of rebellion because it was Joseph's policy that were enabling the Egyptians to continue living. And we can understand too why the Amenemhes would be favorably remembered, because he is the one who had seen to it that there was enough food so that not only Egypt could be fed, but all the countries round about. Now, one more thing about these great statues of Amenemhes on either side of the road to the Fayum. It was called Enik Amenemhet, meaning life of Amenemhes or life from Amenemhes. And this is unusual in Egypt because they generally honor death rather than life. But here is a monument to life because the policies instituted by Joseph got the nation of Egypt through the famine and also all of the nations round about, so that at the end of the famine, they had only goodwill from their nations about them, and there was little cause for war. It was peace to Egypt for the rest of Amenemhes' long reign, which we think was 43 years. So, let's go on to the next slide then. And here we see that Joseph's life in Egypt is in three stages. He begins as a slave in the house of Potiphar. And the Potiphar, who was he? Well, he was Pharaoh's officer and he was captain of the guard. It might be something like the head of the Secret Service in Washington, D.C. But when he was there under the house, under Potiphar in his house, he rises in authority while he is there. The more faithful he is, the more he has to be given as a ruler to reign over in Potiphar's house. But then we get to phase two, when Joseph is unjustly, to be sure, but put into the king's prison. Now, one offhand would think that was a real disadvantage. But while he was in prison, he also rises He rises in authority over the other prisoners, and he even interprets the dreams of two of them. And that would be Pharaoh's butler and baker. Now, it seems evident from the account that King Pharaoh must have had a king-sized bellyache. And who could be responsible for it? It was either the one who prepared the food, the baker, or the one who brought it from the kitchen to his table, which would be the butler. So he puts them both in prison. And there it is that Joseph interprets the dreams. It's a dream of both the bread and the cup. We can sort of see this as a foregleam of Jesus interpreting the bread and the cup of our memorial. Now, Joseph, very low, is put into the king's prison. But there is a big advantage to this in the long run. Wasn't obvious at the time. But who are the other prisoners in the king's prison? Well, it would be those who got caught dipping into the king's treasury. It would be those who misused their office. They would be put into the king's prison. And here, Joseph could just listen to them tell their stories and learn more about government than you could have learned in any of the colleges or universities of Egypt. He became a real educated man about the workings of government because he had learned them from the people who were actually there, not just writing about them. Where could you go to learn more about government than from the other prisoners who had been part of the government? Well, that is stage two. And then he interprets the dreams of the butler and the baker. And the baker is the one who was hanged, and the butler is the one who is restored to his position. Now, that tells us that when Pharaoh made his position, that he discovered that it was the baker who had misused his office and served him poisoned food. But it was 2 years before the butler was caused to remember Joseph and do good to him. And that was because Pharaoh had two dreams. And so he said, I know somebody from prison who was able to interpret the dreams. So Pharaoh listened to him and says, that sounds like a good logical interpretation. We need to do something about it. So he makes Joseph to be number two ruler in all the land of Egypt. And then Joseph makes preparation for those 7 years of famine to save both the land of Egypt and all the peoples everywhere around about. And there again is where he opened up new farmland in the Fayum district. By the way, here's a little tidbit that the area west of the Nile there towards the Fayum district is called Beni Suf. And some have observed that that really can be rephrased Ben Yosef, the son of Yosef, Joseph, or the work of Joseph in making the Fayum district available for growing food and so forth. That's a little minor thing. So we have these three phases or three stages of Joseph's life in Egypt. And let's go on to the next slide for number one. Now, in Potiphar's house, Joseph was found faithful, and he rose in authority in Potiphar's house until it was time for stage two. Now, what does this typify for us? In stage three, he gives every evidence of typifying Jesus, the Savior of the world, the successful Savior of the world. But here in the first phase, he typifies Jesus before his first advent as Michael, the archangel, the number one messenger, the messenger of the covenant, if one wishes. So Jesus was with God as the co-creator of all things. Now, before the two of them had created anything, Jesus didn't have a great deal of authority because there was nothing for him to have authority over it. Until, as he created things, then he gains more authority. And the more that he creates with God, the more authority there is for him to have authority over. So, he continued to rise in authority over all creation until his first advent. And now we go on to the next slide. When Joseph was in the king's prison, we've already talked a bit about that. This was just not an ordinary prison, but into the king's prison, into which the government officials were put when they were caught misbehaving, or presumed to have been misbehaving. Thus, Joseph can learn all about government before he ever had any need to use any of it. But he gained that knowledge. It was ready for him to use. And I'm sure if I had been Joseph, I wouldn't have been able to foresee what would happen next. Nevertheless, while he was in prison, Joseph rose in authority over all the other prisoners. Yes, and he interpreted the dreams of the cup and the bread. But he didn't receive his reward right away. But we see what this foreshadows. Jesus was humbled. He had been the archangel, the one that had worked with God for the creation of the universe, of the solar system, of the earth, of archaebacteria, of plants, of animals, and finally of man himself. And here he gave up that nature and became a mere human being. Could it be more humbling? But as Son of God here on earth, he rose in authority over the rest of mankind. And to us, he introduced the bread and the cup. Yet, he didn't receive the kingship over the world right away. I don't know if he knew how long it was to be, because it said, of the time, day, or the hour knoweth no man. Not even the sun. But we see now that it's more like 2,000 years delay before he receives his kingship over the world. But as he has helped God in recreating 144,000 plus the great multitude during this gospel age, he has been rising in authority even since. Okay, I think we can go now to number three. Joseph now becomes number two ruler in all of Egypt. He was exalted above all the others in Egypt, and in fact, even of his own brethren. And in those 7 years, he managed the 7 years of plenty, and stored up as much food as he could so that those 7 years of plenty could get Egypt through those years of famine, but not only Egypt, but all the nations round about. And it's during this time that the Egyptians, in the 7 years of plenty, the Egyptians don't really realize their need for Pharaoh. Now, it's true, Pharaoh was the firm price support, but most of the Egyptians were quite happy with what they had and were getting. They didn't see their need for Pharaoh at the time. But when the 7 years of famine came, now suddenly they realize if they're going to continue living, they are totally dependent upon Pharaoh. And the stores that he has stored up from those 7 years of plenty. Now we'll notice also, Joseph's wife came from the priesthood. She wasn't just an ordinary commoner, but she came from the priesthood. And so now we look to see how this pictures Jesus. Jesus at his resurrection became the number two power in the entire universe. Remember how in Matthew 28:18, he says that all power is given me in heaven and in earth. Now, it wasn't that he was resurrected and added automatically. It was given to him by his Father, your Father and mine. And we see then that the faithful church is developed during the gospel age to then join with Jesus Christ for the salvation and the blessing of the world. Egypt, and not only Egypt for that matter, but of the nations round about. Now, just as Joseph's wife came from the priesthood, Jesus' bride will be a part of the priesthood forever. Now, there are two duties of the priesthood. Duty number one is sacrifice. After the sacrifice, duty number two is the blessing of the people. And that includes their being brought back to perfection in the 1,000-year kingdom of Christ. So let us be faithful to be a part of the priesthood forever, that we may bless all the families of the earth. And when they are brought back to perfection, the second part of Genesis, of the promise in Genesis, that in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth bless themselves, is the literal. So, yes, one moment. So I think we can go on now to the next slide, because there's also a picture within the picture. Just an aside, there are two very long types in the Old Testament. Some have suggested Abraham is longer, but it's divided into several different pieces. But of continuous types, we have the two longest. Each are approximately 9 chapters long. One is Joseph. The other is the Exodus, which is a picture of the plan of the ages, starting with Jesus' first advent. Now, Joseph and his brethren, that's a picture within the overall picture. We see that Joseph's brethren appear before him. And at that time, Joseph decides to put one of them into prison to be sure that the others will come back. And so Simeon is put into prison. Now, the second time when they come, his brethren have to come back to get more food. His full brother Benjamin is favored, but then because of the matter of the cup, which Joseph actually arranged that now Benjamin is under suspicion. And then Joseph makes himself known to his brethren And he calls for his father and the rest of the family to come to Egypt and survive the famine. So, why was Simeon chosen the first time? Why not choose Reuben? He was the firstborn. Well, we might recall that when they were out to slay Joseph, they put him in the pit while they were deciding what to do. Reuben is the one who goes and tries to see what he can do to free Joseph from the pit. And then Judah is the one who is successful in delivering Joseph from the pit. Let's sell him into Egypt with the slave traders, the other traveling merchants. So he was number four son. So if there's going to be leaders of the sedition to put Joseph to death, it has to be number two or number three, because number five was one of the sons of the handmaids. But number two was Simeon, and number three is Levi. And we suspect then that Simeon was the one that was the leader of the sedition. And also in the matter of Shechem, Simeon appears to have been the leader there. So Joseph's been listening. He speaks to them through an interpreter, deliberately. But he knows what they're saying. And so he learns without doubt, Simeon is the most guilty. So he chooses him to put him in prison. Okay. Now the second time, yes. His full brother is Benjamin is favored with five times as much as any of the others. And his brethren wonder, how do they know that this is someone who is to be favored? Just because he's the youngest of us. Well, Benjamin may be under suspicion, but when Joseph makes himself known and calls his father and the rest of the family to come to Egypt to survive the famine, this pictures something for us. Now, the first time when Simeon is put into prison, that would seem to picture when fleshly Israel receives its double punishment. Joseph's brethren picture the Jewish nation. But one of the Jewish nation was actually his full brother, and that's Benjamin. So he would seemingly picture appropriately the great multitude. So during the gospel age, fleshly Israel is receiving its double during that time. And by that, we don't mean twice as much punishment, but rather like one twin is the double of his brother. Now then, the second time that his brethren return, Jesus, the faithful church with him, in his second advent, favors the great multitude. Even though they are not perfect, he is dealing with them, even as he is dealing with his faithful church. And I think at his return, then, he resurrects the faithful of the 144,000 that have already finished their courses, and then one by one thereafter. We could talk about 1 Corinthians 15:51 and 2 another time in the manuscripts. Now then, as to the rest of Israel, fleshly Israel, already we see them returning to their land. And when Jesus makes himself known to them by their resurrection, they will gain life in the millennial resurrection kingdom. And that's where we have Ezekiel 37, the valley of dry bones. We still await the breath of life in restored Israel, but it will come when Jesus rules. So I think now we can go to our last slide. The lessons for us, we may summarize them. we are to be faithful in all things. Sometimes being faithful means something inglorious, where we are looked down upon. For example, think of what happened when Brother Russell died. What happened to those who saw the call, "Come out of Babylon number two, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins"? What happened to those who withdrew from the later watchtower because they did not want to be a part of the sins that were then taking place? How inglorious to be told that, oh, those who left went back into the world. The lesson for us: always do what is right, no matter the cost. And sometimes doing right may even be to be seen ill in the eyes of some or even many of our brethren. But always do what is right, because God is the judge. Second, let us learn from our experiences. Now, a person has knowledge when he learns from his own experience. He has wisdom if he learns from the experiences of others. Now let's think. We should learn from our experiences. What did Joseph learn when he was in prison? Now, we're not born with good characters. We just don't get that by being born. It takes years of experience and practice. I suggest to the thought, when Joseph was put in prison, did he lose his temper? Or when he had to wait another couple of years after the butler had promised him that he would remember him? We have no record that Joseph lost his temper. You know, temper is a terrible thing. It's bad to have a temper, and it's worse to lose it. So when we have experiences, maybe however inglorious those experiences may be, let's look to see what we can learn from them. My mother used to say, I wouldn't give $1 million. I wouldn't take $1 million for what that experience did for me, but I wouldn't give a nickel to have it over again. And so it can be with our experiences. If I learn from my experience, I might not need to have it over again so that I can learn from it. Let's do our best to learn the first time. If necessary, we'll have the experience a second time or even a third time. But let's learn and learn to do things better because of the experiences we've already had. Now then, the most obvious of all of these lessons for you and for me is forgiveness and mercy. Could Joseph have really done damage to Simeon or to Levi, the two brothers who wanted him killed? Or did he say, this was from the Lord in order to save all of you from perishing? So, did Christ die once for all? Now, if Christ died once for all, should not all benefit? Including that fellow that just cut me off on the freeway? Or highway? Or tollway? Did he not die for the one who cheated me out of something? Let's remember. They would not have crucified Jesus if they had known who Jesus really was. So each person that has done us ill is nevertheless a potential convert in the kingdom. If even the priests of Israel, both Annas and Joseph Caiaphas, if they would not have crucified the Lord of glory had they known, who is there among the people with whom we come in contact that is not a potential reform in the kingdom of Christ, whether his name be Mao, Stalin, Hitler, fill in the blank. Yes, they have been responsible for the deaths of 100 million people. But still, as far as you and I are concerned, each one of them is a potential convert in Christ's 1,000-year kingdom.